The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, the weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China with our indispensable daily newsletter, website, and growing range of podcasts and videos. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the safe, socially distant makeshift studio I have at home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from Nashville, Tennessee, is a man who apparently believes that a sufficiently woolly beard will function just as well as an N95 surgical mask, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, how are things out there in Goldcorn Holler?
They're really good. I feel bad because in some ways I can't complain. Ever since I moved to America with my family 5 years ago, I've worked remotely. And my daily life hasn't actually changed very much. In fact, in some ways, it's busier because suddenly everybody else is remote working too and wanting to talk on the phone and teleconference and Zoom and everything. So, despite the fact that the world is falling apart, our country is run by a buffoon, an incompetent buffoon, and we appear to be heading towards World War III with China. Everything is great in Goldcorn Holler.
Yeah, you know, I'll take all that just because I haven't had to travel at all. It's been wonderful. Anyway, Jeremy, take a moment to tell our listeners about our COVID-19 newsletter, would you?
Yeah, so we decided, since we are in the business of doing newsletters, amongst other things like podcasts and websites, we would like to offer a free service to our readers and anyone else interested. So we're making a daily weekdays update about COVID-19. Usually goes out late morning New York time. It covers COVID-19 developments in America and across the globe, and intended to give you one place to catch up on all the news and give you all the links you need to know to relevant articles. So if you are interested in this, please go to subchina.com/coronavirus and sign up.
Excellent, excellent. Today we are joined by our good friend Dexter Roberts, Tiff Roberts, to talk about his brand new book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. By the time he finally left China in 2018, Tiff was among the longest-serving reporters in China. I think he was topped only by people like maybe Melinda Liu, writing for Business Week, now Bloomberg Business Week, since I think the mid-90s. He is coming to us today from Missoula, Montana, where he makes his home. Tiff, man, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. How are both of you doing?
We're great.
I'm great, man.
We're great, and I can't believe we've never had you on the show before, so a belated but very hearty welcome to Seneca.
Well, I'm delighted to be on the show. I'm a big fan as a listener, and now I get to be on the show.
Yay. Anyway, Tiff, the three of us actually had a ton of overlap in the 20-odd years that we were all in China together, and, you know, I saw you all the time. It's really great to read a perspective on that same China that we all knew or thought we knew, and to find, you know, that there was, in fact, a whole lot that I at least didn't know or didn't think about all that much or not as much as I should have. So the book focuses on rural China and the migrant worker or Mingong experience across, you know, quite a long span of time. It strikes me that while there have been quite a number of good academic books from different fields like anthropology and sociology that look at the lives of the migrant workers and the many issues that they face, I really can't think of many books that have been written for popular audiences that deal really squarely with this issue. So there's the book Factory Girls by Leslie Chang. But that book, which I do think is excellent, has a very different central thesis than yours does, because it focuses on this, you know, empowering, emancipatory effect of the whole rural to urban migration. You know, she tells stories that are meant to kind of go after the sweatshop narrative, and it's a great book. But by coincidence, I read your book shortly after finishing The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson about the great migration of African Americans from the Jim Crow South up to the major northern cities, not west to Los Angeles. I thought there was a ton of overlap. I mean, I kept thinking about that as I was reading your book. Do you think that China's own great migration has certain similarities with that chapter in American history?
Well, first of all, I would just say that I'm a big fan of Factory Girls by Leslie Chang as well, and read it. And I'd say one of the differences that I think one of the things that explains the real differences in our approach is when she wrote that was sort of the height of the migration from the countryside into the cities. And my book coming out early just last week is looking at instead at a very different era when many of those workers are actually returning home. So anyway, that just as a quick note. I mean, I think there's certainly in both cases, both migrant populations have experienced systematic discrimination. I talk a lot in my book about the migrants being, in effect, second class citizenry in China. And certainly you can say that's been the case as well with the Great Migration to the North that you mention in this book.
Sure, absolutely.
One difference, and not to minimize in any way the racism and redlining and all those things, which are absolutely awful and a blight on American history. One difference is that in China, you do have actual policies, these legacy policies that I talk about, that are put in place specifically to ensure that migrants remain in this second class position.
Tiff, let's talk about your thesis, which is really embedded in the title. It's not so much that China isn't, in some sense, capitalist. It's just that there are massive and often overlooked costs to the Chinese miracle. Is that a fair characterization? Or if I may be direct, what exactly is the myth of Chinese capitalism?
Yeah, first of all, I do think that is a fair characterization. And I mean, the myth that I look at, or the myths that I look at, I would argue there's several parts to them. And sort of the big picture is the myth that China is becoming more capitalistic. And by capitalistic, what do I mean? Basically that these very real economic reforms that powered this tremendous surge of growth ever since Deng Xiaoping are continuing. And I think it's pretty clear to me, and I think to many others, that they're not continuing the way that they were, particularly over the last 5 years or so. More to the point of the book, another myth is the idea that the Chinese middle class, now that it's pulled in many of the urban residents along the coasts in particular, will keep expanding, and that the migrant workers and their cousins in the countryside, which together, by the way, you know, it adds up to maybe 500 million people. We're getting close to half the population of China if you look at rural hukou, or rural household registration, migrants plus rural people. And of course, is far larger than the entire population of the U.S. And so the one key myth, I believe, is that those people are somehow going to be converted into spending middle class consumers.
No, I mean, I completely agree, and it's a terrific book if I haven't said so already. One of the devices that I think really works, that makes the book so good, is how you illustrate each of the different themes in the book with a place, all the while you anchor the whole thing on this one family, the Mo family, who are from this impoverished area of rural Guizhou province. But maybe give us an overview of the different themes that you bring to the book, and then maybe talk about the different places that you use, that you traveled to, that you reported from, to relate those themes, you know, to really illustrate those themes, like, you know, rural education and the origins of reforms, or the plight of the elderly, or land requisitions, labor unrest, all that stuff. What can you give us a quick sort of map, a geographic map of the themes that you talk about?
Well, in terms of location, you know, clearly to a degree, cities or villages are, you know, sort of the main characters in the book. And the two that I focus in on, of course, are Dongguan, which is sort of export capital to the world in the Pearl River Delta, where...
Did you say escort capital of the world?
Well, that too, yes, unfortunately, although there was a crackdown on vice there. But along with the factories, yes, there was a... It had a notorious reputation for nightlife and escorts and so on, particularly for the Taiwanese and Hong Kong business people that ran the factories there. But in any case, I focus in on Dongguan as the sort of emblem city that's emblematic of the factory to the world model, which is the place, the factory to the world is where so many of these migrants have been employed over the last couple decades. And then look at the village of Binghua, or Binghua Cun. Cun obviously is village, in rural Guizhou. And this is deep in the interior of China. And although it's special in some ways, it's also emblematic of the interior of China, which in general has lagged in, you know, key indicators from income levels for the people there to access to education, to access to healthcare. So those two places are sort of the stars of the book, if you will. I first went to Dongguan and Binghua Cun together in the same year of 2000. I was working on a story for Business Week called The Great Migration, which was the first time I really started to follow this phenomena of the migrant workers. In the following years, I went back, you know, dozens of times to both places, particularly to Dongguan, as I wrote about manufacturing and the rise of the export economy, often focused on looking at it from the factory manager's viewpoint, but then later also looking at the rise of a labor movement. So those are sort of right. The two stars in terms of places of the book.
But there are many other places you report.
There are many others. So, earlier on in the book, when I'm looking at some of the very earliest labor movements, I was up in the northeast in the old Rust Belt of China. The labor movement and protests really started there in the early 2000s in places like Liaoyang in Liaoning province, and then which is a place that I do mention in the book. There were huge protests at an old ferroalloy plant there as China went about and Zhu Rongji, the reformist premier, started to reform the state enterprises, and China experienced its first mass layoffs, maybe 30 million people laid off in the late 90s, early 2000s. So that was...
The Xiagang Wenti at the time.
The Xiagang phenomena, when, you know, the end of the Iron Rice Bowl, right? So that's another place I look at. On the land side, you know, I spent some time visiting Xiaogang in Anhui province, which,
right.
You know, all old China hands like yourself know is where the household responsibility system was born and where the dissolution of the communes happened, which led to this, you know, great rise in rural incomes. But then, as I argue in the book, later stalled. And so Xiaogang is another sort of key location in the book. And, you know, just there, we've looked at Dongbei, the northeast, Anhui, not too far from the coast, and then the Dongguan down, an hour and a half or so from Hong Kong, and then deep in the interior in Guizhou. So one of the things that really struck me about doing this book as I decided to write it was that this is really one aspect of the story of China writ large, the migrants and the factories. Crucial to China's economic model up until today, and encompassing people from all over the country.
Tiff, let's talk about the Mo family and why you decided to use them as the anchor, really, to the book. In some ways, they are very typical of what's happened in China during this great migration. But in other ways, they're really not very typical in that they're from the mountains of Guizhou, an area of extreme poverty that's very remote, and was accessible only by horse-drawn cart until just a few years ago. And also, they're not Han. They're an ethnic minority, right? So can you tell us about the major characters in the Mo family who feature in the book and about the place they come from?
Yeah, so when I went when I went down to Dongguan and then later to Guizhou, I was looking for some migrant workers. And as a journalist, part of the story happens because finding those people that are willing to talk to you and have interesting life stories, and they certainly fit both of those categories. And so the Mo's are very different in many ways. As you say, they're this ethnic group, the Bui people, which a lot of people outside of China have never heard of. They speak a dialect that's very similar to the Zhuang, which, if I'm not mistaken, is maybe the largest ethnic minority. And so they're very similar to the Zhuang. They're very similar to the Miao or Hmong people, actually, that we've got a significant population of people from the Hmong ethnicity living in the U.S. as a legacy of the Vietnam War, of course.
But I got to say, Bui is a pretty cool name for an ethnic group.
It is. Bui Tzu.
Yeah, is it cloth clothes, right?
Yes, 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 absolutely. So they are very different. On the other hand, the challenges that they have confronted in their lives, I quickly discovered, due to the household registration policy, due to the fact that education in the cities is not accessible to the children of most migrants, the healthcare issues they felt, where even as a migrant goes and spends most of his or her life working in the cities, they often cannot bring their elderly parents there because of problems getting access to urban and healthcare. All of those things that the Mo's very much experienced and still experience today are emblematic of the whole migrant population. So those people that I met, my first introduction was to Mo Ruxuan, who was an up-and-coming party official, and basically was introduced to him through a friend of a friend. And it was an interesting story how I ended up in Binghuatsuan. He was actually working in a neighboring township next to Libo being the township where Binghuatsuan is. And because he was in a neighboring township, he, first of all, very much wanted to focus some attention on his village. This was 2000. It was 1 year after the U.S. and China had signed the bilateral accession agreement to enter the WTO. It was 1 year before China was about to enter the WTO. And keep in mind, everybody knew in 2000 that China would enter because the U.S.-China agreement was the most important bilateral agreement that had to be signed. And as soon as that was signed, we actually had a good idea when China was going to enter, which was the end of 2001. So
right.
This village, like many other places across China, was trying to figure out how they could, how their lives would change and how their local economy might change with WTO entry. And this local official, Mo Ruxuan, was delighted when I contacted him to have me go visit and do a story about his village. Again, this is back in 2000. And on that first trip, I heard a lot about different ideas about how people hoped that WTO, entry to WTO, could transform their place. And they were hoping that it might bring in Chinese investment from elsewhere in the country. And they were very hopeful that it might bring in foreign investment or American investors that would. One idea that I kept being told that people were hoping for back then was money to set up a processing factory so that they could actually process the vegetables that they grew there, which, you know, range from tomatoes to chili peppers. So anyway, Mo Ruxuan, I was introduced to him. I went and met him in where he worked, in his office. Because he wasn't actually an official, a local official in the township where his village was, he was willing to talk to me. You know, you guys know
right,
China well.
Right.
If he had been working nearby his own village and been in charge of it, we would have had to go through a whole bunch of hoops to make the visit. But instead, he arranged the visit and talked to me as an official in a neighboring township.
Great.
And I made that first visit. And on that same visit, I met Mo Ruxuan, his brother, who that first visit I barely remember. He was called back by his brother to be basically a host for me. And the reason why he was called back was because Mo Ruxuan had been one of the earliest migrants to leave the village. That meant that he'd actually learned to speak semi-standard Mandarin. He'd been working all over the country, as opposed to a lot of the people that stayed in Bui, who most of which couldn't speak Mandarin. They spoke the Bui dialect, which is very similar to the Zhuang dialect. And the Mandarin they spoke, you know, as you would imagine, had a very thick accent. So Ru Chun came back, and he met me at the horse cart that deposited me in the village, which was necessary because the road was so muddy at that time of year. And so I met him. And, you know, today he's a fairly successful entrepreneur who's tried a lot of different businesses in his time. And many of them haven't been successful, but right now he's doing okay, working in the lumber industry in neighboring Guangxi, but also has a home back in Libo, the local township where Binghua is. So he is another key character, and I can keep going, or we can.
No, that's good. I mean, it's really they're the brothers who are at the center of it, and Mo Ruchun, of course, has children, and it's the fate of those children that are left behind by parents who end up migrating to work in factory towns like Nungguan that is one of them, I think a really interesting part of the early chapters of the book. I think probably most of our listeners are familiar with the plight of the left behind children. But your book focuses on a lot of detail that I at least wasn't fully aware of. One thing that struck me was the fact that, for example, you had been talking to somebody who was working on this issue in Hong Kong, and she said that children of migrants who are left in the countryside who get sent off to boarding school after age 5 or whatever, they come back to their villages with real disadvantages when it comes to the standardized tests, the Zhongkao to get into high school and the Gaokao to get into college. Can you talk about that in particular and some of the other educational issues that are that these left-behind children confront?
Yeah. That scholar, by the way, is Anita Ku. And she, with some other scholars, focused in on what they call the doubly disadvantaged youth. And those are kids that, as you just described, who actually do spend several years of the first years of their education with their parents in the cities, with their migrant worker parents. That often is complicated by the fact that, as you know, they can't usually get into urban public schools in most cases. They end up in private schools that cater to migrant children that are often actually relatively expensive and don't provide usually as good education. So what happens is as the Zhongkao gets closer, the test to get into a good high school, they're not eligible to take that test in the cities, and they're not eligible to go to high school in the cities. So what they have to do is they go back to their villages. And one of the sort of surprise findings that Anita Ku studied was the fact that that's actually, that often puts them in a position where they're actually not very well prepared. One of the reasons why is because as China has tried to move away from its emphasis on just rote memorization and make its education system basically better, they've experimented in the cities with moving away from that focus on memorization.
Right.
And, they've introduced new topics and so on. That hasn't really happened in parallel in the countryside. So these kids could go back, they take the Zhongkao, they do as well as they might do. And they get into these high schools that are much more traditional and focused on rote memorization. Often that combined with the fact, so that actually puts them at a disadvantage. The first disadvantage is the fact that they're often these not very good private schools in the cities. The second disadvantage is now they're not actually doing very well in the rural high schools. You have to add the fact that these are often quite impersonal boarding schools. They're far away from their parents.
Yeah, they sound hellish.
Yeah, they're far away from their parents. They're cooped up in these dorms, sometimes 12, 16 high school kids to a room. And it's not very pleasant. And while China has put an enormous amount of money in trying to improve rural education, much of it has gone into, as is the case so often, has gone into physical infrastructure. So you go visit these boarding schools, as I did, and they look pretty good. They're these big concrete hulking buildings there. They often have sports fields. They're not that old because the money came in the recent years and they built new schools. There was a huge rush to build more boarding schools, and a lot of them were built fairly recently. But that sort of emphasis on building up the physical infrastructure in most cases has not been matched with the soft infrastructure. The level of teaching.
Yeah, they have a lot more in common with like a Dickens orphanage than they do with Exeter Prep.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah, I did a story which was for Business Week, which was called China's, the title, which I wasn't responsible for, but fairly accurate, was China's Dickensian boarding schools. So these kids come back, and what happens is they very frequently drop out of high school. So you have this tremendous problem with rural dropouts, kids of migrants, who then basically are cycled back into something similar to their parents. They don't get their parents often weren't very well educated. Education's gone up amongst migrants. But now you have these rural kids going back, dropping out, and therefore they can't get a good job in the new economy. And they end up going back and doing the lowest of the low jobs, whether it's back in the factories, construction sites, or some of the service jobs that are out there, the really tough ones, like the motorcycle delivery jobs.
That's right.
Tiff, what about migrant schools in cities? This has been a big issue for a long time, closing of schools that were serving the children of migrants, and often very heartbreaking stories over the past few years. Why are municipal governments in first-tier cities so opposed to these schools?
Well, if you look at, again, the first-tier cities like Beijing, there's been a real effort to actually reduce the migrant populations. And of course, we saw several years ago with the big fire, the Daxing fire, there were outright, you know, there were mass evictions of migrants from Beijing and then later Shenzhen and other cities around China. And these cities, again, Beijing and Shanghai in particular, have actually set, you know, they like to set targets on population growth. They've actually set targets that reduce the population. And so there's pressure to move out the migrant workers. At the same time, you know, they're the migrant children. And so what's happened in many cases is when municipal officials decide that there are too many migrants, they, you know, the one thing they can do, which is very heavy-handed and they've done before, is order apartment buildings to stop renting to people that don't have local hukou. But another very effective thing to do is to shut down the private schools that cater to the migrant workers' children. Because if your children can't go to school, the migrant workers, the whole families need to move on to find some place where they can put their kids in school. And that's been quite brutal. I mean, we've seen whenever there is this mandate to reduce the migrant population, typically they go after the schools. They always have an excuse. It doesn't have the proper licenses. It's a fire trap. You know, the building's not up to code. These things may be true, but usually the actual motivation is more about pushing migrants out of the city rather than trying to, you know, have safe schools for migrant children.
So we've talked about the kids. So in these empty nest villages all over China, these kongchaocun, you rarely see working age people, of course, just these children, but also the elderly. We've talked about the kids. What about the aged in China, especially in rural society where, you know, there's always been this expectation that people of working age are supposed to take care of their parents? Obviously, that's not going to happen when they're often in Dongguan or in Shenzhen. So what kinds of pressures do the elderly face?
So, you know, obviously the elderly in China everywhere face some of the same challenges, same pressures, but there's different pressures and sort of a heightened challenges for the rural elderly. First of all, it's happening faster in the countryside. And that's, you know, that's sort of simple arithmetic. If the young people are leaving the countryside, then obviously you're going to have an average older population in the countryside. So it's happening much faster there. The problems that they face become more severe when you look at their lifestyles. Many elderly in the villages, along with taking care sometimes of young children who in many cases get parked when they're very young with the grandparents in the countryside, they also typically will work in the fields sometimes into their 80s. The World Bank has actually done research on this. And so they don't retire like people do in China's cities. So this can be often backbreaking work. You know, typically they have a very small plot of land. That's typical for all of China, for most agriculture. And you've got, and it's not very mechanized. So you have literally these, you know, you have very elderly people, sometimes into their 80s, bent over trying to tend little fields. So you can imagine the sorts of physical problems that come with that. They have higher rates of untreated hypertension. They have higher rates of respiratory diseases.
Right.
Another big, big one is depression, frankly. There's a huge problem with depression in the countryside amongst the elderly. Overall suicide rates, sadly, are, you know, they're three times higher in the countryside than they are in the cities. Many cases, they're reliant on checks, you know, remittances being sent back from their children who are working in the factories. But that doesn't, you know, that only helps as much as it can. That doesn't mean they can't keep working the fields. So I guess just one other thing, you know, in China's efforts to eradicate poverty, which they've made, you know, very substantial and impressive progress in, they have had to actually focus on rural elderly poverty as well, because it's still a serious problem. You know, the empty nest phenomenon, which they, the Kongqiaocun, I'm messing up the tones, I'm sure, but that's because it's an empty nest. These villages end up being very elderly, often with infants. The very elderly typically have very low levels of education. They're not reading bedtime stories to those migrant little toddlers, I'll tell you that. They don't necessarily have training in taking care. When they raised kids many, many years ago, it was a different era in China. And so they don't have the skills to raise young children as well. So it's a very real problem for not just the villages themselves, but for the migrant worker population as a whole.
Tiff, the conditions you describe in the early chapters of your book from your earlier visits to factory cities like Dongguan are pretty appalling. There are workers sharing narrow beds, working extremely long hours at dirty, dull, and or dangerous tasks. But over the last 20 years, how would you describe the improvements, if any, in conditions at such factories? And what has driven those improvements?
Well, there's been tremendous improvements. So those factory conditions that I describe early on in the book, many of those have gone away. It was really the definition of sweatshop labor back then. Back in the, you know, the bad old days in the late 90s and early 2000s, typically these workers would show up at the factories. They felt very blessed to just have that job. They would have to hand over their household registration booklet or their hukobar in order, and they'd hand it over to the factory manager. That would, in effect, kept them prisoners in the factory. The factory manager was like, what else do they want to do? You know, they're migrants. Their job is to work in my factory. They don't need to go wander around the town. They'll probably get into trouble. And so, of course, I should take their household registration booklet. But what would happen is they'd get picked up by police if they did venture out of the factory. And, you know, there's this terrible phenomena with the black jails that migrants were mistreated in. They would be picked up by the police. They wouldn't have their household registration booklet, which they were supposed to have on them at all times. And they would be thrown into these quote unquote black jails and often have to pay large fines. Sometimes their relatives would have to gather money and bring it together to get them out of these black jails. The conditions, as you say, in the dormitories were pretty bad. The food was pretty bad in the cafeterias. A lot of that began to change as really sort of with the demographic shift in China and the fact that this and also the fact that there were fewer and the numbers of migrants coming from the countryside every year into the cities started to slow down. Now it's basically stalled. So that growth that basically provided very, very cheap labor to the factories of new workers started to slow down. You know, what happens then? Wages start to go up. Workers actually started to have a bit of, you know, sort of the labor management balance of power started to shift a little bit. So these workers would be like, yeah, the practice of handing over your household registration to a factory manager quickly vanished. You know, no factory manager that asked a worker to do that could get the worker to stay there. They could walk down the street to a new factory. And so so there was a real shift. And, you know, at the same time, we saw back here in the U.S. The rise of a whole movement against sweatshop labor, initially targeted at Nike you know, all the students organizing on university campuses. And suddenly the big labels like Nike and others were very conscious of the, you know, their reputation and the fact that that they could be hurt if these scandals emerged about mistreatment in their supplier factories. So they started to police it as well.
It's great that the demand side consumer activism really helped. That's marvelous to hear.
Yeah, no, I think it really did. And I spent a lot of time with Nike going through factories, and they're showing me how they were trying to root out illegal or bad practices in terms of management of workers. And they were sincere. They didn't, you know, they didn't want to see their stock get hit by a boycott or something because of stories of a sweatshop emerging there.
I just want to ask you something about the labor conditions there. You know, one of the things I used to hear when I was a reporter, you know, on trips down there, you were talking about how they could just get up and walk down the street to the next factory and get another job. Well, I mean, this was something that Nike and all these other companies were actually encountering all the time, that they wanted to comply. They wanted their factory managers to comply with these, you know, overtime laws. But it was actually pretty difficult because the bosses couldn't really pay time and a half on weekdays for overtime and double wages on weekends because the margins were so slim. So they tried to keep the workers to just their 40 hours. And then the workers would just, you know, as you say, get up and leave, right? I mean, their thinking was, hey, I didn't come all the way here from rural Guizhou, so I could just work 8 hours a day and, you know, watch TV or play cards in the evening. They wanted as many hours as they could, overtime or not, right? Did you encounter this?
Yeah, I did. And another thing, I should give credit to the Chinese government here as well. They passed a very important labor law, which put into place those requirements on paying for weekends and holidays, double and triple pay. They put into place a labor contract law, which dealt with the actual contractual stuff between workers and management. And they were, by the way, they were actually talking to German scholars of labor. And they put into place a labor law that was actually quite strict and quite pro-worker. And so that was the other part of it. The big brands and retailers started to discover that their suppliers were not meeting the new law, and this could be a real serious problem for them. So they started to try to ensure as well that these new laws that the Chinese government had put into place were being enforced. The phenomena you mentioned, I absolutely encountered that. I talked to many a factory manager that said, you know what, when I tell workers, you know, first of all, they would say, I can afford to pay them their regular payment. I used to give them overtime, but now I'm required by law to pay them double for overtime. I simply can't do that. My margins are too tight. So what I do is I limit my worker to, you know, whatever's the maximum hours that they can work a week. And then I try to find other workers for production. And workers literally were walking away because they were saying, in some cases, they were saying, you know what, I don't need double time. I just want the 50, 60 hours. And I have got my relatives and my family back in the village. I'm sending money back there. I'm ready to work really, really hard. And the factory managers were saying, I can't do that anymore. I'm going to get caught. Right. There are all these inspectors. There are a whole new phenomena of inspectors going through the factories that the labels and the retailers were hiring to try to find any infractions.
You did that. You actually went along on a ride-along, right?
I did, yeah. Yeah, and it was quite an eye-opener. This was early enough that there were some real sweatshops out there. Not that they've completely disappeared by any means, but there were more of them back then. Yeah, I remember one really memorable one where I was going into a toy factory with one of the inspectors from a big retailer, so he was an in-house inspector. So they would hire third party firms to do it, and some of them would do it in house. And so he basically said, oh, "Well, I will be, you know, we're going to show up around this hour," and we showed up instead 30 minutes early, and the manager, you know, was red in the face and nervous. And, you know, why did you get here early? He tried to lead us into a little meeting room, which is the first thing they always do to distract us. And, you know, pulling out the books to show us that everyone was being paid the right amount, to show us their ages, to make sure there was no underage labor. And the guy I was with, who was an old pro, was like, okay, we'll do this at the end. We want to go onto the factory floor right now. And we went in there, and it was they were making Disney figurines. So it was not very nice. There was an overpowering smell of paint and rubber. and mainly young women, but, you know, probably old enough, of age, not underage, sitting on these lines. And the guy I was with said, wait a minute, what's that door back there? And he'd been doing this long enough that he knew
there's always that door.
They would have, you know, you'd have to go through the back, the secret door in the back to see what was really happening. And the guy became extremely nervous, the factory manager. Ultimately, he had no choice but let us open the door and let us through. And suddenly, it was much poorer conditions. There wasn't proper ventilation. It was hotter. The air conditioning wasn't on in there. And the people, the young women again, looked very young, like there were girls there. And some of them, God. Some of them leapt up and tried to hide behind their line mates. And, you know, we quickly figured out that they were 15 years old in some cases, which is against the law. So that was quite a few years ago. It was in the mid 2000s. And I'm happy to say, you know, a good portion of that has been reined in the following intervening years.
Wow. So in the face of these sometimes terrible conditions, in many other countries, you might see an organized labor movement. But of course, in China, organized labor outside of party control is taboo. You detail some cases of labor unrest, though, including the Yang Yuan strikes of 2014 and the Jassy case of 2018, which has also been in the news last year. Can you talk about the Communist Party's fraught history with labor and wildcat strikes, and about the efforts supposedly underway to overhaul the All China Federation of Trade Unions?
Yeah, well, so the union system in China goes way back. It was actually created in 1925, and at the time it was actually modeled on the Soviet Union's worker system. So we have the All China Federation of Trade Unions. The first thing you have to know is that it is firmly under the control of the Communist Party, and it's, you know, it's nothing remotely like an independent labor union like we might experience in other countries in the world. And so Vladimir Lenin had this line about how the union should be a transmission belt, which basically would work both ways. The concerns of the workers would rise through the union on the transmission belt to the party cadres, and they would then be able to take action to answer and be responsive to the workers' concerns. On the other hand, the transmission was supposed to go the other way, which is the party's ideology, the proper consciousness, all of that should be conveyed through the union back to the workers. And so the union has always been very much not independent. And, you know, this goes way back. So in the late 50s, there were huge labor strikes in Shanghai. And at the time, the head of the ACFTU, the union then, a gentleman named Lai Ruoyu, actually spoke out and said, the workers are protesting because the union is not doing its job, and it's not answerable to the workers, and it's not trying to improve their lot. And, you know, he was promptly purged for saying that. It was considered that was not his role to criticize this organization. So, you know, fast forward up until the last few years, I think in 2015, the ACFTU, it's the only union in China. It's become a bit bloated. It has an enormous bureaucracy. At the same time, there's major labor protests happening. The one you just referred to at the Adidas suppliers, which brought in tens of thousands of workers, deeply alarmed, not only Adidas, but the Chinese government. And Xi Jinping, the leader, launches this whole-scale effort to try to reform the ACFTU. Much of it good. He tries to cut the bureaucracy, so it's fewer full-time staff actually running the union. He does try to, like, bring in more migrant workers who have typically been underrepresented in the union because they're migrants. They move on and they don't join the local union because they're not long enough in one factory. And he set up these sort of ACFTU, these union, All China Federation of Trade Union service centers around the country. The backdrop to while he's doing that, there's a massive crackdown on the independent labor movement, which has been growing in strength. And we have these different, sometimes sort of almost barefoot lawyers, self-trained lawyers, say a worker who decides that, you know, that this is very important and trains himself in labor law and starts to represent workers. And these NGOs representing workers start popping up, particularly in Guangdong. So there's a massive crackdown on them. And there's, you know, a number of people that were, most of the people that were running these various the most effective independent labor organizations are now in jail. Very sad. I mean, these are people I knew quite well, who I spent a lot of time with over the years talking to. They were very high profile, and many of them are in jail now. So on the one hand, he's trying to reform the ACFTU and somehow make it more answerable to the worker. On the other hand, he's doing this very vicious crackdown on this independent labor movement, which had become quite effective in trying to help workers, including in that Adidas strike. I just, one last thing, there's a clear emphasis on trying to sort of rebuild the transmission element of the union. So on the one hand, the union is supposed to do a better job of representing the concerns of the workers, and their concerns are supposed to rise up to the administrators in the party. On the other hand, there's a very, very marked effort to try to start teaching party principles and the correct, whatever that might be, the correct attitude you need as a worker and as a member of a workers' union to the workers. And there's a lot of study sessions and learning party doctrine that actually comes through the union now, which did not in the past.
Hey, Tiff, just a real quick question for you. You talk in your book about China's e-commerce boom and its transformation of the Chinese countryside, this whole phenomenon of Taobao villages and so forth. You even have the head of the World Bank gushing about how this is a huge game changer for people in rural China. How impactful in your assessment has this really been, and how much of this is just spin from Alibaba and JD?
Well, you know, it's a real mixed bag. It's clearly a real thing in terms of it happening, these Taobao villages.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, in some cases, empty nest villages that we were talking about earlier, because of Taobao industry, they've actually been able to draw back some of the younger people or the middle-aged people who can actually work in this cluster of factories that now do their, you know, business through Taobao. So it is actually happening. But one of the interesting and somewhat alarming things that I did see is, you know, these are the nature of a Taobao village and a Taobao factory is small, often started by former migrant workers themselves. And they're not, I guess I would say they're the last, this type of factory is small. Sometimes it only lasts for a short period of time. The last thing they're concerned about is labor law. The last thing they're concerned about is factory conditions. The last thing they're worried about is underage workers. So in some of these Taobao villages, and probably more widespread than we realize, a lot of these old sort of sweatshop conditions are being resurrected. They basically fly under the radar. They're not, you know, if a city wants to, or a township wants to clean up its labor sector, they go to the bigger factories, the ones that actually might pay the fines and help the local coffers. And these Taobao factories usually are untouched. So there are signs that sort of some of the worst practices of the sweatshop era are being resurrected in the Taobao villages.
Very mixed bag.
Absolutely.
Tiff, in some ways, I think you could say this book is about two major injustices, the dual land system, with the addiction that local governments have to land sales as their only means of raising revenues, and then also the hukou system. But let's talk first about land. What's at the heart of this problem?
Yeah, so those are really the two legacy policies that I argue are the biggest obstacles to China continuing on its economic, basically carrying out this economic transition from factory of the world to this new, they're very clear what they want. They want a much more consumer-driven economy. They want a much bigger service industry. They still do want manufacturing, but they want to be making higher value-added goods, and they want the factories to be far more automated, which is in tandem with the rising wages. So the land system that China has today, again, a legacy of the Mao era, makes a distinction between rural and urban land. So it's often called shorthand the dual land system. And there's some great scholars looking at this. One example, Susan Whiting at the University of Washington. And so basically what happens is, in according to the official doctrine, the land in the countryside is still collectively owned. So what does that mean? That basically means that the people that till the land or hold the land, and migrant workers typically will have a small plot of land back in the countryside as well, are not able to really monetize it. So if they do rent it or if they do sell it, and there are experimental programs to try to encourage renting and selling of rural land, typically the value they get is very, very low. And one of the biggest reasons is they are unable to take, say it's an agricultural plot of land, which it always is, they are not able to rent it or sell it for industrial or commercial use. So it's got to be rented as for agriculture. Now the catch is, it is possible for that land to be converted. It's just that the farmers and the migrants can't do it. Local officials have the right to reclassify agricultural land as commercial or industrial. And in fact, they do it all the time. And this has given risen, you know, so they reclassify it. They buy it, or they buy a purchase agreement from the farmers, and they reclassify it as urban or industrial, and commercial or industrial. And then they can sell it on or rent it on to, you know, a factory or housing development. And typically the value that they get when they do that could be 10 times as much as what the farmers actually got or the migrants got. And so that's the situation in the countryside. There's been talk about reforming it. One of the very biggest obstacles is the fact that local governments are heavily reliant on these revenues from converting land and selling it. And so in order to solve that problem, the Chinese government needs to figure out how they're going to support, you know, where local governments are going to get their revenues from if you know, a third to a half of it was coming before from land-related proceeds, and that goes away if instead the farmers and the migrants are benefiting from it. Now, this system in the countryside stands in, you know, marked contrast to the cities where, as we all know, there's been an explosion of wealth built on the ability to rent, to buy and sell apartments. Even if it's just a 70-year lease, which it is, the assumption being that the government will give them another 70-year lease after the first one expires, and I think they're starting to do that. So in the cities, people are able to actually make large, huge amounts of money from selling their apartments. And this is, by the way, probably more than anything else, explains the very large and fast-growing income and wealth gap in China today, this distinction between rural and urban land.
That's absolutely right. As we said, the other fundamental problem is, of course, the hukou system, this internal passport system. And I think it's fair to say that most people recognize at some level that it's a deeply unfair system, and yet it's been incredibly difficult to try to reform. Can you explain why that is? I mean, is there any realistic way that you're aware of that you can reform or abolish the hukou system without creating these, like, suppurating, ulcerous slums of the sort you see, you know, in Bangalore or in a lot of large cities of the global south, and without overwhelming the social services of the big Chinese cities?
Well, I mean, that's a real concern, and that's one of the main reasons why they have moved as slowly as they have. And they really have moved slowly. I just remind you that they announced with much fanfare in 2013 at a third plenum that year that they were going to move quickly to reform household registration and the land system. And there's been very, very limited progress, small pilot programs and so on, but they're still so far away from that. So one of the major concerns indeed is that the cost will be too high, that the, you know, integrating migrants, their children, their families into urban healthcare and urban education is just simply going to be, you know, exorbitant. So that's one very big issue. And I should add, there is a bit of debate on this. There are Chinese scholars and some officials that think that simply won't be the case. You know, the migrants have proven themselves to be very hardworking people. They come to the cities to work. They don't come to just hang out. And so another argument says, actually, no, they will become, tax-paying new citizens. And actually, it's not going to be as expensive as everyone thinks. And a similar argument with the slums. It's like, the people that are supporting the reforms will say, look at the migrants today. They're not really living in squalor, even when, the system is built to make life difficult for them in the cities. They've done as good a job as possible in difficult circumstances to make, decent lives in the city for them and their families. The private schools for migrant kids is one example. So there is an argument that can be made that says, actually it's not going to be nearly as expensive or socially destabilizing to bring these people into the cities. A huge obstacle, which is not always remarked upon, is the urban people themselves. Probably won't be a surprise to either of you with Chinese relatives, as I have as well, that many with urban Chinese relatives, many people in the cities, first of all, they are under enormous pressure. It's extremely difficult for them to go to a hospital already in the city. The lines that people have to wait in, perhaps it's gotten maybe a bit better, but it can be brutal to actually get a doctor's appointment. Bribery was very common in the past as well to see a doctor in the cities. Getting your kid into a good school in the city is extremely competitive. So we have the whole phenomena of the, what do they call the shuifangqiu, the basically people buying these insanely expensive rundown hovel apartments in a particular part of a city like Beijing, simply because that allows them to put their kid in the neighboring school, the school that's nearby. So there's huge competition already. Some of the most notable protests by urbanites in recent years have actually been related to efforts by the government to do the right thing, in my perspective, and bring more migrant children into urban schools. And what we've seen is urban parents literally going down to the Ministry of Education. This happened in Nanjing a few years ago, and it's happened in a bunch of other cities, and protesting and saying, do not let those migrant kids into our schools. It's hard enough already for my kid to get into a good school. So there's huge resistance. And this is something that, to a degree, makes things more difficult for policymakers as well. This sort of...
These are the same people who emigrate to the U.S. and end up voting for Trump because of affirmative action. God.
I'm afraid so. Assholes. I'm afraid so. And I mean, the HUCO system, keep in mind, despite... There's a great irony in the fact that it was put in place by Mao. At that time, mainly aimed at... having a sort of a docile population in the countryside to grow the crops to feed the industrial workers whose kids the technocrats who would man the steel factories and try to make China leapfrog and catch up with the world in steel production. It was a very Stalinistic idea, and so this idea was, we'll keep people locked on the farm and in the communes later in order to make this whole thing, to power industrialization. So urbanites in China have for decades been used to this system. And it'll be you won't be surprised to hear this. It's very common to hear, I don't know what the right expression is, classist expressions by urbanites about the nongmin. Farmer is an insult.
I was going to say, in my first year in Beijing, I worked at a factory, a joint venture factory, and I was shocked within the first week to learn that my colleagues, I was supposed to be teaching them English, used that regularly as a term of insult, because I thought I was coming to a communist country, and that was way back in 1995.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's really ingrained. And, Y-D-R-N and...
Y-D-R-N is an insult in most big cities.
The idea that crime is brought in by the migrants, when in reality, as we all know, cities like Beijing, would basically grind to a halt without the migrant community. The food delivery, the IEs, everything, you know, the restaurant staff, all of that is migrant workers. So I think there is a real problem in these sort of the resistance from, I call them the elites, although many of them are not elite. They're elite in the sense that they have a household, an urban household registration or a Beijing household registration, and they have no desire to see the integration of migrants and their families into the cities.
Yeah, let's ask a final question and bring it right up to date with the pandemic. Tiff, how do you think the COVID-19 epidemic in China, which Beijing is now claiming it has gotten under control, claiming, I would stress, how do you think it's going to impact migrant workers in China?
So far, we've already got signs of how it might, and it's not a pretty picture. If you look at the cities now, there's things seem to be sort of returning somewhere close to normalcy for the urban residents. White collar workers, you know, they can work from home or they're going into the office once a week. For the migrants, obviously, you know, they can't work from home, whether they're working in a restaurant, a delivery person, or in a factory. And so in the first month or so, we saw many of them completely unable to actually even return to the cities where they had worked. And we also, by the way, as you know now, probably every urban housing development now has extra strict policies for entry and exit. And everyone's afraid of the virus coming back, which is fair enough. But unfortunately, there's been many reports about migrants who had rented places in the cities or on the outskirts of the cities who are now being banned from returning. And in some cases, you know, very dramatic, back to sort of like the Daxing expulsion tactics, like shutting down the electricity in apartments that migrants have been living in, or shutting off the water to drive them out. So that's actually been happening as well. I do think sort of the larger picture, I think some of these ingrained biases that urban people have against migrants, sadly, are only going to be reinforced with COVID-19. I think there is a legitimate fear of the virus returning, but this sort of us versus them, urbanites versus these outsiders who come from far away, don't have good access to healthcare. Those attitudes, I think, are, and sort of the bias against being with them, I think, are only going to grow. And I should say that this is happening against a backdrop of, as I mentioned earlier, a national policy of trying to drive automation in the factories. And so, I mean, migrants before COVID-19 were already not feeling welcome in the cities. The trend is to try to encourage them to leave, sometimes forcibly make them leave. Certainly that's happened in Shenzhen over the last few years. Some of the big migrant neighborhoods, they've just shut them down. They order the buildings to stop renting to migrants. And the no uncertain message is go back to where you came from and try to reinvent yourself there as an entrepreneur in a service industry. And so it was already not particularly welcoming to the migrants, becoming less welcoming. And I'm just afraid that with COVID-19, that tendency is only going to be strengthened.
Well, that's a depressing note to end on. But Tiff, I can't let you go before I tell one little story that you are basically the first and thus far only person to have actually said to me, and for very good reason, dude, your hair is on fire. We were at Baifeng's bar, the nameless bar on Hohai, like 20 years ago. It must have been like 20 years ago.
Kaiser,
and I had leaned over a lit candle.
Yeah, I remember this. I remember this very well. I'm glad you brought it up. And you, I should note that my response, although, you know, sounds funny now, was the proper one, because
it was,
your
absolutely.
Hair was on fire.
Your hair was on fire.
I didn't want to, you know, first of all, I think I might have even smelled it first, because y'all know how burned hair does not smell good at all.
And no, it does not.
And back in
even
my,
mine.
Back in my dark past, I had rather long hair myself. And I think I might have actually been in a similar situation. And sadly, I didn't have a friend call out as I did that day with you fast enough to
I am glad I had you as a friend then. God, yeah, that was terrible. Tiff, man, thanks so much for taking the time. And remember, the book is called The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, The Factory, and The Future of the World. Highly recommended. It's really an excellent, excellent book. Tiff, before we do recommendations, I want to remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like this podcast and the other fine shows in our network, the way to keep us going is to subscribe to SubChina's Access newsletter. For just $88 a year, you get this excellent newsletter delivered right to your inbox. You get early ad-free access to this podcast, and you get discounted admission to our major conferences and free admission to our live podcast recordings. Lots more too, so sign up and show your support. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, start us off, man. What do you got?
Sure. I mean, just before that, I'd like to just the stories about your hair being on fire. I'm very glad that the surveillance state as it is now in China did not exist back in the early 2000s for a number of reasons. But my recommendation is a lot of people like me are stuck at home with their kids, no school. Mine are 5 and 7. And my wife, Wu Fei, who is a musician and composer, has been recording videos of her reading children's books and poems, both Chinese and English, and setting it to improvised music and sharing them on Facebook and other social media for other parents who are looking for stuff to entertain their children and hopefully not do it in a too mind-destroying way. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
If you've got small kids, you know, I guess anywhere under the age of about 10, it might work. I'll post the links to the various social media pages, or you can just Google her, Wu Fei.
Okay, Tiff.
So this is an old classic, but in a book that I was sort of reintroduced to in the writing of my book, but highly recommend From the Soil, The Foundations of Chinese Society. This was published in 1948 by a gentleman named Fei Xiaotong, who is one of the premier scholars of the Chinese countryside. And, you know, he was also probably one of the founders of modern sociology in China. He studied actually his PhD in sociology at the London School of Economics. But anyway, he has this book, which is a wonderful classic, which is interestingly still timely today. And so basically back then in the 40s, he laid out this, you know, radical belief that any viable future for the Chinese countryside, and particularly for the farmers involved in giving agency to them. And he didn't have a clear path forward, but he said we need to find a way to help them take control over their futures. He had ideas about, you know, rural industry that could be developed. He had ideas about trying to push democracy at the local level in the countryside. For his efforts, he later got in trouble, as you will not be surprised to hear, by the Communist Party, and was banished for many years, emerged late in his life, and sort of a chastened individual, very sad, never talked about some of his radical early beliefs again. But this book by him, again, From the Soil, The Foundations of Chinese Society, is a remarkably sort of prescient look at China, its relationship to the countryside, and worth still reading today.
Wow. It, you know, I remember him when he died in the mid-2000s. I was just sort of shocked to realize that he had still been alive.
Yes.
As I mean, he must have been, well into his 90s by then.
Yeah, he spent about 20 years in exile after being outspoken during the 100 Flowers Movement. You know, at one point cleaning toilets for years, apparently. And then in 1976, with the death of Mao, was finally rehabilitated and was sort of able to reestablish a sort of tightly controlled form of sociology in China.
That's great. Fei Xiaotong. I am going to re-recommend the first two novels in Hilary Mantel's fantastic trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, set in, you know, the Tudor court, in the court of King Henry VIII. I just re-listened to the second book, Bring Up the Bodies, to just kind of refresh me, because I'm about to plunge into the final volume, which just came out, The Mirror and the Light, it's called. The audiobook versions of these books, at least the first two, are just wonderful. I cannot say enough good things about just the narration, especially. I mean, it just, well, obviously her writing is phenomenal, but the narration really captures all the subtlety and the wit and the nuance of Mantell's writing. Since we're all basically sheltering in place, I don't think there's a better time to take up the habit of listening to audiobooks. So check it out. That's my recommendation for the week. Dexter Roberts, Tiff, man. So great that we could finally make this happen, and hope you're enjoying life back in Big Sky country, back in the States. Sorry, you know, you had to come back in such dark times, but welcome back.
Well, yeah, well, thank you. We're making the best of it here, and delighted to finally get on your guys' show.
Yeah, well, we're going to have you back again soon.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, Tiff. That was a lot of fun. Let's do it again.
Okay.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Gula and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out all our other podcasts in the Seneca Network: the China in Africa Podcast, Tsai-Sin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz, our two shows focused on women, New Voices and Tafata, the Middle Earth Podcast on the culture industry in China, the China Marketing Podcast, and Strangers in China. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows coming soon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care, wash your hands, and don't touch your face.